Flashback Twin Cities on Club 1220 KLDB. Tom Osmond here with you on another Saturday afternoon. And with me again is Tom, technical producer extraordinaire.
You can never get rid of me.
No.
And besides, I like this show too much.
Well, I'm glad we got at least one or two, right?
We got one or two fans out there.
We were on hiatus last week. We actually had a rerun on, which I think most of it aired. It was good to have the Bud Kraling and Al Lotsberg program on again, and got a lot of good feedback on that. It's always good to get Bud out here.
That was definitely one of my favorite ones we've done.
60 years in broadcasting, Bud.
I think they said between the two of them, they have something like 100 years.
30 years.
Of media experience.
Between us two, we got about 6 months, but that's okay.
We're working there.
Working on it. So it's a big week in the news. But let's talk about news that happened 27 years ago. Or actually 26 years ago. 26 years ago, on July 23rd, 1987, the Twin Cities metro area was hit with a powerful line of thunderstorms that produced tornadoes, damaging straight-line winds, and historic flooding rains. What were you doing, sir, 26 years ago?
26 years ago, I was walking really quickly and then falling down because I was just a little baby.
All right. Well, I was slightly older than a little baby. And it was one of those days where it was a really hot day, and you kind of knew that the atmosphere was just not going to be nice or kind. And we've talked about it before on this show, because somehow we've managed to be on the air with some of the worst weather the last year has had, that Minnesota tries to kill us, albeit a flood or a heat wave or a cold snap. We're just – what is it about the state that we still live here, yet the weather's trying to constantly kill us?
Well, we got all these other states that are trying to kill everyone else that live there, so why can't we?
So let's go back to the day on July 23rd, 1987. Most of the day was sunny and hot, with temperatures in the low 90s. Then, in late afternoon, thunderstorms rapidly developed west of the metro area. And this is from Care 11, by the way. This is not my prose here. Thunderstorms continued into the morning hours of July 24th with the heaviest rains in the South Metro. Many parts of Hennepin County, Minnetonka, Eden Prairie, Richfield picked up 6 inches of rain in 6 hours. It was the most recorded rainfall in the Twin Cities in history, and still is that day. What was a drought year actually was made up within one night. Let's play some audio from, this is Care 11 Sunrise, that aired only hours after the heart of the storm.
In case you are just joining us, here are our headline stories. The storm that roared through our area overnight left extensive damage and hundreds stranded at Southdale Mall in Edina. Up to 3 inches of water in some spots covered the floors. In some of the stores, the ceilings gave way. The floodwaters gushed down staircases. Hundreds of employees and shoppers were stuck at the mall. The roads were just as bad in Bloomington, and a mudslide added to the problems there. Several feet of water covered East Bush Lake Road. Trees collapsed onto cars, causing a mudslide. A second mudslide happened nearby as well when a retaining wall collapsed. And at the airport, stranded travelers had to wait out the storm in the terminal. Hundreds were forced to spend the night on any available bench or chair. The torrential rain and lightning strikes combined to knock out the runway lights, and that stopped all air traffic.
Well, most of the summer, of course, we've been talking about one of the worst droughts we've had here in years. But as meteorologist Paul Douglas reports, it took only one night to turn that all around.
Several tornadoes. The video, which you can see at tcmedianow.com and type in July 23rd or Superstorm, you can see people canoeing or kayaking through urban streets. Basements had 2 to 7 feet of flooded water. Many collapsed basements. Retaining walls collapsed. You can see the airport. You can see businesses are just extensive damage. The Supermarket gas station has like a foot of water in it. Someone's trying to pull up their car.
Oh.
There's another video on tcmedianow.com. You can see it. It's Debbie Ely. We've had her on the show a couple times. We played this audio last fall, so I'll let you go and play it on your own. But she's actually reporting the news from 3 feet of water on highway. I think it's Highway 100. And the best part is you see a news van right there with the microphones and the wires coming, you know, dipping down in the water. That was a superstorm, the biggest storm. It was called the Storm of the Century. Then it was called the Superstorm. In Twin Cities history, we call it the Superstorm. And we've had a lot of damaging winds and rain this year. I think that the first month of June, after we had that snowstorm, which ended, I think, in June 1st, then we had the rainfall and the storms. It still not, it pales in comparison to one night of storms back on July 23rd, 1987.
Was it a drought that year as well?
It was not a bad drought. We actually had 2 years of bad drought the years after. So you get dumped with water, and then for 2 years, you're stuck. We got a great show today. We have Ron Majors from formerly of KSTP-TV, but now of WLS-TV in Chicago. And Ron Majors, not Paul Majors, there's two Majors. One was here for about 12 years, and one was here for about 20 years. But we have Ron Majors today, and we'll be back with Ron Majors after this break on KLBB Flashback Twin Cities. Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. And joining me from Chicago is Ron Majors. Ron, welcome to the airwaves of Minneapolis again.
Very nice to be here.
Let's take a step back to the year 1974, and you were working in the West Coast, correct?
I was. I was in San Francisco. I had spent all of my early career on the West Coast. I grew up on the West Coast. I was born in California. I worked in radio and television in Washington, Oregon, and California. And in the 7 years just prior to my coming to Minneapolis, I spent in San Francisco from 1968 to 74, when we thought all the news in the world came out of San Francisco. We had a few things going on out there with the Vietnam protests and the free speech movement at Berkeley. It was a great time to be a reporter.
And you did reporting and anchoring.
I was reporting and anchoring. I started out doing the morning news in San Francisco in general assignment reporting. Then I did the morning and noon in general assignment reporting. And then I did the noon and the six in general assignment reporting. And then for a while I did the noon, six, and seven. I ended up doing the six, seven, and 11. And then they ran out a later newscast for me to do.
All-night news, maybe, just to replay it?
Pardon?
A little all-night news, maybe. That's before the
yeah,
era.
I could have done all-night news, like all-night radio.
Well, we're at the point now, I think, where we have news on 24/7, even in local stations. What prompted you? Were you looking for a new job? You were working in what was the pulse?
I was looking for another kind of challenge, and Stanley Hubbard called me kind of out of the blue, and offered me a job in Minneapolis with the possibility that I could anchor the newscast and end up being news director as well. And that was an interesting possible combination for me, because I was still interested in management. And I went to work for Stanley, and for a couple of years I did both jobs, not long after I got there, where I was anchoring the news and was news director. And what I learned about that was it was really a very difficult combination, because, you know, the news director is supposed to be looking at the big picture, trying to make improvements in the product, while the anchor is supposed to be sitting out front selling the work of all those people who are working so hard behind the scenes. So I'm sitting on the set trying to do the best job of selling our product, and as news director, I'm thinking, that story was terribly done. I'm going to have to kill somebody when I get off the air.
Well, and luckily no one did get killed, and we're grateful for
luckily
that.
Luckily no one got killed. But it was just kind of a strange dichotomy is what I learned, and so I eventually stepped away from that, but stayed there and anchored the news for a long time. And from 1974 to 81 in Minneapolis, I had great success working for Mr. Hubbard and his operation.
Well, let's talk about when you came to Minneapolis. Had you been to Minneapolis-St. Paul prior to accepting a job here? Had you come?
No, I had never been off the West Coast prior to taking the job in Minneapolis. In fact, when I flew out to interview for the job, there had been a real cold snap, a real, you know, one of those didn't get above zero for a while, and the day I got there, the cold snap had just ended, and the high temperature was going to be 20 or 21 degrees, and here I come from San Francisco to meet these people, and we're all going to lunch, and because it was 20 degrees after the cold snap, nobody wore a coat, Yeah. I was just stunned. I was freezing. Here were all these businessmen just in their suit coat seeming to enjoy walking around in the 20-degree weather. There was a learning curve for me about Minneapolis, but what I came to learn is that what corporate recruiters used to say about Minneapolis, and I'm sure it's still true, is that you had a hard time getting executives to move to Minneapolis to take a job, but eventually you'd have a harder time getting them to move away.
Right.
Once you've lived there for a while, the level of education is very high. Everyone's really has an opportunity to be well educated and are well educated in the Twin Cities. But in addition to that, there was a survey done many years ago that really impressed me, looking at the delivery and availability of what they called culture in the Twin Cities. And it was highly available and at a reasonable price. I've always described my experience in Minnesota when people who haven't ever lived there try to understand it. What I say about it is there's this interesting thing about Minnesota to me that they've maintained this sort of Scandinavian tradition of social responsibility,
right,
while having fiscally responsible and somewhat conservative local communities. And I've always found that part of Minnesota very interesting.
Yeah, it's a combination of the Germans and the Scandinavians. It's social, socially responsible, fiscally responsible, and a very much a community here for one of the biggest cities actually in America. It is still a small town, and with that, people that are in the media as yourself, you become very connected toward the audience, and the audience connects toward people in the media greatly. I think more so than maybe in New York or L.A.
There's no question about that. And the other thing is, once that connection is made in the Twin Cities, it almost never goes away. I still regularly get stopped on the streets of Chicago by people who will say, "Excuse me, Mr. Majors, I'm from Minnesota, and I watched you when I was young, or I grew up watching you, or I watched you and your brother." Now I get a lot about the people who grew up with my brother Paul, who's been gone for a while now.
Right, 10 years.
He's been out in L.A. And it's a little bit like country music. They used to say about country music, if you can make it for a while, you'll make it always. And I think when the Twin Cities accepts you as someone that they're willing to invite into their home, that lasts for a long, long time. And it's really been, it was a wonderful experience in my life.
Well, I have a promo. This aired actually even before you were on the air at KSDP, and I want to play this for you right here. We're just going to talk about that. Go ahead, Tom.
Majors, Ryder, Zivan. We got who you wanted, starting February 11th on KSTP5's Eyewitness News.
Okay, that was Ron Majors. He's on his way.
All right.
Ron's on his way.
Right, Ron's on his way.
Is he married?
Majors is on his way.
Majors on his way.
Majors, Ryder, Zivan. We got who you wanted, starting February 11th on KS.
February 11th, 1974.
Yeah, it was funny. They had a lot of fun with the promotion department had an awful lot of fun with that.
Yeah, there's actually a whole reel of these I found along the way, and they are quite popular on the internet. There's a lot of this stuff that was probably never thought to be seen again, and some way I find a way to keep it alive.
I've seen some of the stuff you've posted on the internet, and it really is fun. And you had some stuff I didn't have, so thanks very much for giving me a look at it.
I think that we talked before a couple weeks ago before the interview that one of the very few newscasts, full newscasts with you on there, full 30 minutes, is on tcmedianow.com if you want to see Ron Majors do the news again.
I'll tell you what's really funny to me is when you look at the technological changes that have been made in television over the past many years, those old newscasts look really, we were working so hard to do such a good job. By today's standards, they look so out of date and almost out of touch, and kind of they're really formal. There are a whole bunch of things that wouldn't make them successful now. But I also remember that, you know, a friend of mine once told me that any picture you take today will embarrass you in 10 years.
Right. Are you embarrassed to see those newscasts from 30 years ago?
And I like it. I really do like it. It's kind of it brings back a feeling tone for me. I can remember, you know, what it felt to be working there in that time and the technology that we were working with. Remember when I was at KSTP, the Hubbard family, they were among the first in the country to go with live color cameras
right.
in the field. We were the first ones to do that technology outside of the networks. And the Hubbards have always been very eager to be kind of cutting edge in technological terms, and we really were. It was fun to be part of it.
Well, they were a pioneering family. Color, you know, first of all, first TV camera, I think, in the nation they owned, and then, you know, color video and color TV. And you probably came from a world that was still using film back in the West Coast before you came to KSTP, still using film and probably developing film before you could run stories. And then again, at Channel 5, you're doing the same thing. So a lot of time took place to do a half-hour newscast at 6 o'clock.
It's, news has expanded so rapidly in recent years, and I think a significant part of it has been all of the technology that allows us to do it so much more quickly than we ever were able to do it before. I mean, when we talk about breaking news now, we're really talking about something that is either literally happening now or has just happened that we're able to turn around and get on the air almost instantly. When I first started at KSTP in 1974, you know, we were still shooting film, and you had to process the film, and then you had to edit the film and get it on the air. It was a lengthy process simply to get a story on the air. Now, it really does happen before your very eyes.
And a lot of human beings took place to do these half-hour broadcasts. A lot of bodies in the building, a lot of bodies that had to do this work.
Oh, yeah. We're much more efficient about what we do. We can do it all with fewer people now. One of the issues I have with television these days is, for many, many years, almost every technological advance was something that allowed us to do our job better in terms of getting more news on the air, getting it right, getting it first, doing all that stuff. In recent years, what has happened is television stations have adopted some technologies that I think have not moved us forward, and in fact, in some ways, have moved us backwards. Some of the computer technologies that are now used in control rooms kind of marry us to a script in a way that we didn't used to have to be married to it. Now, before we do a broadcast, it's all loaded into a computer, and it's loaded and coded in such a way that it's a bit cumbersome to make changes on the air, on the fly. We used to be able to do that much more easily. It gets a little tougher to do now. The programs will look cleaner, and they'll look slicker, and the graphics are better than we've ever been able to make them before. We're able to do graphical representations of things now. On the networks the other night, when there was a plane in New York that went down and the front landing gear collapsed and people had to get off the plane quickly, there was not only video of that, but that and the Asiana airline incident in San Francisco, within an hour or so of those incidents, the network newsers were able to create very lifelike graphic representations of what had happened on those fields. Those things really do advance our storytelling abilities, but the stuff we do in the control room to get the newscast on the air is actually in some ways more cumbersome than it's ever been.
Well, interesting you bring that up, because I actually want to ask you a question about that from your experience in news. We've now almost given everyone with a camera or a phone, they're now reporters now. And I know that a lot of news stations here in Minneapolis, I'm sure in Chicago, are taking footage straight from phones, which, by the way, look better than some of the cameras that were thousands of dollars 20 years ago. But, you know, there's an abundance of information, and then there's also a control factor. What's your thoughts on how the information is being filtered, you know, from citizen journalists all the way from the control room or from the news dispatcher to the air?
We are really in kind of a scary moment because computer graphics are so good that almost anybody can mess with video in ways that leaves it looking very realistic. We can take a piece of video and make it into almost anything we want to make it in now. We can take a video of an interview with you and literally put words in your mouth.
Right.
That can be done very easily. So I think it's really important that people trust the folks who are providing them with the information, and that trust is built up over many years. You need to know when you're watching me or your favorite newscaster that we're people who wouldn't do that kind of thing and wouldn't tolerate it. Where it gets a little scary is, reporter goes out on a story. As soon as you get to a story that is a breaking news kind of event, whether it's a fire or a crash or a building collapse or whatever it happens to be, all reporters now immediately ask around, did anybody see anybody with a phone? Did anybody see anybody taking pictures? Did anybody here take any video? And what we really want to do is we want to make sure we're talking to the person who took that video and we see it in their hand on their phone.
Right.
So that we know it hasn't gone somewhere and been doctored. When video surfaces much after the fact, we have to really be concerned about, is this actually what happened? So there are some scary things about that. And the other thing is, with the Internet now, anybody can put anything they want on the Internet. It happened to me last night. I had a friend who called me and said, hey, I just read this on the Internet. Is there any possibility this is true? And I said, there's no possibility it's true. Here are a couple of sources you can check. You'll see for yourself that it's not true. Now, that was a friend who wanted to check it out rather than just repeat something that might not be true. What happens on the Internet is stuff gets repeated so many times that it begins to take on the air of truth because you've seen it so many times, you begin to think, well, gee, it's all over. Must kind of be true.
Someone saying something over and over again, does that make it true? Which somehow in the media pushes up, and I'm not accusing any particular media group, but it's just the media in general, whether it be internet, TV, radio. A story is out there enough, then the facts of the story become less important than the characters or some of the moment itself.
It is true that it's very, very difficult anymore to determine. Let me put it in a different way. It's difficult even to trust your own eyes anymore because video can be manipulated so easily that what you see isn't necessarily what happened. I don't know how all this will shake out. I like the idea of citizen journalists. I like the idea of more people exposed to the process. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, a long time ago, said, truth is more likely to be found in a multitude of sources than from any authoritarian choice. I don't want an authoritarian choice. I don't want only one person, one network, making the decision of what everybody sees. I want us all to see as much as we can see. My concern is, how do we as individuals separate out the wheat from the chaff? How do we find the sources that we trust, and how do we know when we can trust even what we see?
When you came to Channel 5 in the 70s, there was two daily papers here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, morning and afternoon edition, and then there was three news stations that were producing a product. The message that the media audience received was very controlled. And now in 2013, there's seven or eight different TV stations on every night. There's one or two papers in big cities. And people are getting most of their information, I think, especially people in their 20s or teens, from their phone. And I'm guessing that you probably work with a lot of people from your generation and then also from Generation X and below, that they don't recall the era where you had three stations and you had two or three products. Do you find that just the way or the discipline of gathering information, gathering your facts, is different now than it was even 10 years ago?
Well, it is. I mean, it's a very competitive environment, And you're right, the audience has splintered to the point there are so many choices and so many options. When you mention young people, people in their 20s, who most of whom no longer pick up a morning paper, most of whom don't regularly watch a television newscast, and when you say they get the information on your phone, what scares me the most about that is there have been survey after survey after survey indicates that those kinds of news, and I put news in quotes here, consumers, don't really look for news. They think if it's important enough, it will find them. Because they tweet, so they're looking at Twitter. Because they Facebook, they're looking at Facebook. Because they Instagram, because they Pinterest, because they have a homepage they look at. They just make the presumption that if it's important enough, it will find me. That's a scary part of the process for me, because I think you need to make some effort to find out more about things that you see. You see a headline. I think you need to make a little effort to find out where the headline come from. What's the story behind the headline? Are there other versions of that story that I need to know about? That's the way I'd like to see it work. My fear is it doesn't work that way, and surveys seem to indicate time after time that it doesn't work that way, that especially young people now presume if it's important enough, it'll find me. I'm concerned that that's in many ways breeding a less than fully informed citizenry.
My guest today, Ron Majors, from WLS-TV in Chicago, formerly of KSDP-TV. Just this conversation we've had, and one thought I talked about before, and I want to ask your opinion on this, is in 1974, Watergate took months to uncover and to bring to the public. Right now, we have politicians right now who have very openly done things which are corrupt or could be immoral, illegal, and the news cycle is so much faster now, and the way that we, again, we've talked about before, are tweeting or images are popping in and out. Do you find now that it's going to be tougher for politicians or tougher for people in power to be able to do things corrupt or even say something that might be off, you know, inappropriate one time without their careers being ruined? Do you think that we're going to be holding politicians more accountable now?
Well, I think the inappropriate comments are always going to float to the top because they're quick, they're easy, it's easy to take the sound bite and it gets repeated 100 times and everybody sees it. There is, for example, there's a controversy going on right now within the Republican Party that's pretty indicative of the issues facing the Republican Party. There is a congressman named King from Iowa who made a comment about legalizing undocumented people in America, referring to the Dream Act. And the example of the Dream Act is kind of always an undocumented young person who's a valedictorian of a high school class who was brought here at the age of 3 by parents who were undocumented, so was never able to become a full citizen of the United States. Here you have this outstanding young person. How do we find a way to legalize them? Well, Representative King said that for every one of those valedictorians, there are 100 young people who weigh 100 pounds and have calves the size of cantaloupes because they've been drug mules. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, immediately disavowed that comment and said there's no room for that in the Republican Party. Congressman King, being confronted now by the House Speaker of his own party, stood up to him and said, I'm statistically correct. For every valedictorian, there may be 100 drug mules. I mean, he's now going to have a fight with his House Speaker about his remarks. And it's the very conservative wing of the Republican Party battling with the center of the Republican Party, if you will, in the person of John Boehner. John Boehner reacted by today calling out Congressman King and saying it was an ignorant remark. Now, what's interesting is all of those little quotes that I've mentioned are going to get repeated over and over again. But I don't know if anybody has gone back and looked at the full context of the remarks that Congressman King made. Have they looked at the full text? Has the media looked at the full text? Has Congressman Boehner looked at the full text? I have. I've gone back and looked at the full text, and I'm comfortable that I know exactly what he was trying to say and how he said it. But
do you think he's being misunderstood?
Are his remarks simply insensitive, or are they statistically correct, would be the argument. And as long as the remarks themselves are so inflammatory, all we're going to kind of hear are the remarks.
Well, remarks is what sells a product, and it's what the opponent will use in their commercial.
Absolutely,
this fall, and I guess you know kind of what I was getting at. Partly is politicians are human beings too. People in business are human beings too. And if you look at what with Paula Deen, you know, this last summer, some remarks that were made are inappropriately, and her career is it's on ice right now. We have a mayoral candidate in New York who has done some things I think some people might find morally repulsive, but is continuing on. Are we going to be at a point where we're only going to be able to elect very bland people into office, or only be able to have very bland CEOs because they're not going to have any background of any kind of sound bites or any Googleable actions or things they've said? That we're going to have, you know, really some people that are not going to be able to be very effective because they don't have a lot of charisma or a lot of things. Because when you have a lot of fire in the belly, you're going to say some things that maybe you regret.
Yeah, I don't think there's any great concern about that. I think in the two examples you cite, there were things in the background that made those remarks even bigger. In the case of Congressman Weiner, he had reached the point where he said, you know, everything is out there. I've told you everything I need to know. That you need to know, and then it turns out, no, there were more things that he hadn't told us. In the case of Paula Deen, there was a lawsuit in the background by some of her employees saying that this kind of behavior had gone on for a long time. It's not just the remark that was made. We're talking about a pattern of behavior. So I don't think there's any concern about – there's always been a concern about will good people run for office – because their life will become will go under such scrutiny. That argument has gone on for 50 years that I know of that I've been in this business. So it's not a new phenomenon, and it's not just as a result of the soundbite era. It goes way back to years and years ago when why would someone want to put their own life under that kind of microscope? I would always hope that we would have people who would be willing to do public service and would think that their ideas are the kind that they need to bring them up in the public marketplace.
Do you think the scrutiny is harder now, though, than even a few years ago? Because now everything's on tape now. I mean, no matter where you are or where you if you're talking to someone or you're making a speech, everything's on not video, but everything's recorded now. Digitally.
I would make the argument we're better off that way. And the example I would give you is, in Illinois, we have the urban area of Chicago and the collar counties. And in Illinois, we call everything else, in Chicago that is, we call everything else downstate. Mm-hmm. Whether it's north of us, south of us, or west of us, doesn't matter. That's downstate. The rural areas are downstate. And people forget that while we've got this great urban center in Chicago, when you get to the south of Illinois, you are in the south of America.
Right.
You're in the southern United States by the time you get to the tip of Illinois. And for many, many years, we've had politicians who would give one speech in Chicago and a completely different speech in southern Illinois. Well, because everybody's got cameras now, they can't do that anymore. They're held accountable for everything they say. And in the end, I think that's pretty good for the process.
You know, to a lesser extent, in Minneapolis-St. Paul, we have the same, you know, we have it's outstate or it's metro area. We have Minneapolis-St.
Sure.
Paul, and that's where a lot of the money and a lot of the power gets driven from, and there's outstate. Rochester or even up Alexandria, Brainerd. But that is good. I do agree with you, though. I think that we are going to be holding people more accountable. You know, like I said, my only concern is: if everything we say is going to be on a constant, you know, recorded device, it's going to be tough to have to explain everything you said in your life. But maybe that's for the better.
I think in the end it probably is for the better. I think particularly for those people in public life, whether they're corporate chieftains who are supposed to be setting an example for the whole company, or whether they're politicians, I think we're probably better off if we're held accountable for what we really do say and what we really do mean. The thing you may be getting at is, should you be held accountable for a slip of the tongue? You know, maybe not, but that should be obvious.
Mm-hmm.
If it was truly just a slip of the tongue, or whether it was really an exposure of what you hold in your heart.
Very true. Our guest today, Ron Majors, will be back in 2 minutes on KLEB Flashback Twin Cities. Flashback Twin Cities on Club 1220 KLEB, talking to Ron Majors. Let's lighten the mood a little bit. I want to play, let's take it to the year 1979. Let's play some audio.
For the precipitation, 60% later tonight and tomorrow, 30% for tomorrow night. Here it comes.
Well, you gave me a perfect idea of what to get you all for Christmas. I'm going to get you that little face mask for all three of you. I think that'd be great.
Great. That would be really nice. I'd like that.
No, I thought so.
And Bob's already got one. That's right. Used it. That was when you broke your face on the snowmobile, wasn't it? In sports, the Olympic hockey.
Do you miss the days of discussing snowmobile races on the news desk?
Yeah, there are. You know, there are some things about Minnesota that people don't understand unless you've live there. You know, it's hard to explain to people outside Minnesota that, for instance, in the winter, that on Lake Mille Lacs, a whole new town grows up on the ice, complete with pizza delivery and mail delivery in the ice shacks. You know, those kind of things are fun. I also, there was Governor Rudy Perpich, when he was elected, he actually had a polka mass as part of his official inauguration ceremony. When I very first moved to Minnesota in 1974, I knew I had some things to learn when I was watching it was Mel Jazz. Mel Jazz used
right.
to do
sure.
used to be on the air, and I'm sure you got some stuff of him on the internet.
We do.
And Mel Jazz had an ad in his morning show. For you'll see these ads for certain kinds of hits, record hits, hits of the 50s, hits of the 60s, gospel hits, love songs. This one I'll never forget was 25 Golden Ukrainian Favorites.
Of course.
And I realized at that moment there might be some things I need to learn about Minnesota.
I mean, was there a point when you got here and you thought, okay, now it's 20 degrees is warm and 25 Golden Ukrainian hits? You thought, what have I done? Well, I moved away from San Francisco and now I'm going to be going to a polka mass.
Yeah, you're right. There, I did have some second thoughts on occasion, but what you learn is the texture of communities in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota is endlessly interesting. And the other thing I absolutely loved in those years, and I can only hope it is still true, is that Minnesotans generally would not put up with corruption in politics. The first example of that was there was a council member in Minneapolis who, not long after I got there, was voted out of office. And the controversy was he had accepted a $200 campaign contribution from a bar, restaurant owner who had a liquor license pending in his ward. And that was just too much for some people. That if you're going to eventually make a decision on that guy's liquor license, you shouldn't be taking money from him as a campaign contribution. That was a legitimate campaign controversy, and I loved it. I loved that people would even think of it, that, you know, just the appearance of impropriety is enough.
No, it is true. In fact, when I lived in Chicago for 3 years, one of the – and I love Chicago, by the way, and I love living there. One of the surprises I had was when I came there was – there's a lot of tolerance of politicians of what they're able to do and not do. And I was trying to explain to people that I became friendly with, in Minnesota, there's politicians, there's a mayor here in Minneapolis that had put out a newsletter. Well, the newsletter turned out to be more of a campaign ad for himself, and ultimately ended up paying back the city, I think it was $10,000. It's, you know, small peanuts in the world of politics and corruption, but Minnesotans, Minneapolis, people in Minneapolis, St. Paul, they just don't tolerate that.
No, and I'm fascinated by that, and I hope it is forever so. You're right. In Chicago, we have developed a tolerance that is far too great for corruption. I think part of it is, honestly, that a certain percentage of us have just kind of given up. Well, that's the way it always was. It looks like that's the way it will always be. Very rarely down here do you see a real backlash to examples of public corruption. I mean, it truly is sad. I think we put up with way too much in Chicago.
The one thing that surprised me when I first moved there was the mayor's name was everywhere. I thought, this is a great campaign idea. You can put your name everywhere, and you never have to spend a dime on actual campaign materials.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and as soon as a new mayor was elected, the old mayor's name comes off, and they spend a lot of money putting the new mayor's name up. When you land at O'Hare, as you're leaving O'Hare, the first thing you see is a great Welcome to Chicago sign from the mayor.
Right, right. And at the cost of the taxpayers. Taxpayers can pay for your campaign.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip for you, and I want to talk a little bit about this. This is from 1979 also, and this was in the height of ABC's Charlie's Angels era. And I want to see if you remember this clip.
Bronco cheerleader.
I want to assure you that this is a local news cutting. We have nothing whatsoever to do with the Playboy roller disco pajama party. There is more trouble in Iran. The crisis continues there. We have a story of a Thanksgiving reunion. Two boys in Afton, two small Vietnamese boys, have finally been reunited with their mother, father, brothers and sisters, and an aunt and uncle after 4 years of separation. We'll have that story and more for you. Those of you who've turned off your television sets in disgust, wait about another half hour. We'll be back with the news.
There's some. I'm not sure if you could get away with that today.
Well, I didn't get away with it then.
Uh oh.
What happened was there really was. Imagine this: some network executive, somebody comes to him and says, "Hey, I got a good idea. Why don't we do a show called the Playboy Roller Disco Pajama Party, and we can have girls bouncing around in baby doll pajamas on roller skates, and they can do the disco too, and who wouldn't watch that? I mean, I didn't know that show was on, but when I sat down to do the news brief in the middle of that show, I'm looking at the show going, how in the world could this get on the network? I mean, it was just such a crass decision. Trying to play the lowest common denominator of everything they could find, I was just stunned by it. And being stunned, suddenly the red light goes on and I'm on, and that's what I said. Well, there was a bit of a backlash. I mean, my bosses at the time weren't too happy that I had said that, but it was what was on my mind and what I said. Now when you say you don't know if I could get away with it today, you have to remember that since I've been in Chicago, I walked out on a job, a good job at NBC, because I had a general manager who actually wanted to put Jerry Springer on our newscast as a social commentator.
Right, we were discussing that. Yep.
Jerry Springer was taping his show in the NBC building where I worked in Chicago, and we had a general manager with a brain cramp who actually wanted to put Jerry Springer on the newscast as a social commentator, and my co-anchor and I both quit. So it wasn't just that moment. When the moment calls for it, I think over the course of my career, I have stood up for those things that I think are right, and I have spoken my mind, and sometimes I've gotten in trouble for it, but I think it's more important for me to stay the person I am than the person somebody else wants me to be.
No, we're watching a clip of this video, and this is actually someone sent me this video. It's really, I mean, to be able to see one of these moments on video is pretty fascinating, because you don't see a lot of that in TV. Calling out your own network or your own bosses on what the programming is. We were just looking at this and thought, how could you even sit down and try to write a serious news copy when you're watching this, and then 5 minutes later, you're supposed to watch a serious news show within, you know, 10 minutes later.
It was crazy, and the whole thing was crazy.
And on the same point. Jerry Springer, in 1997, I think, was the year that we were talking about that before, also before he came on the air, when he was going to be the social commentary. I mean, that was the height of his program's, I guess, you know, de-evolution of TV talk shows. I mean, I've never watched it. I've seen clips of it, as I'm sure you probably have in the past, very brief moments of it. How would one even think to marry those two of putting something that has exposed some of the worst parts of society into what at the time was the number one news program in Chicago, which I don't think needed a lot of help.
No, it was a crazy moment by the guy who was general manager, and his argument was, the general manager's argument was, forget Jerry Springer's show and how bad you think the show is. Jerry Springer was a guy who had held public office. He had served on the city council in Cincinnati. His political career came to kind of a strange end when a hooker who was arrested ended up having a check from Jerry Springer in her pocketbook. So that little controversy kind of cost him his political career. But nevertheless, this general manager was arguing that this was a guy who, at one time, he was in the television business. He was a newscaster. He was a city councilman. So he has a background where he could offer social commentary. And I said, no, he gave all that up when he decided to do this trashy TV show.
Right, right. All that.
What he's now known for is the trashy TV show. As soon as his face goes on the air, all anybody knows is trashy TV show. Why is he sitting on the news set? So if you want him to sit on the news set, you can't get me to sit on the news set.
Right. I mean, all that goes away when your brand image is chairs being tossed around a stage and lots of screaming and yelling. The viewer's not going to separate that, and your brand image is not going to separate that.
No, it's very difficult to once you work so hard to gain the trust of the audience. Why would you throw it away in a moment like that? And actually, that ended up being the argument that helped me get out of my contract at NBC. I finally went to them and said, "You're putting him on the air. And by in doing so, you so severely damage my image that I won't be able to continue to do the job you hired me for. And I'm going to sue you to protect my own image." And once they realized that I was digging my heels in and I really was going to sue NBC over the damage to my image as a result of this decision, they finally were willing to release me from my contract, and I took a few months off and then went across the street. And I've been here at ABC in Chicago for the last 16 years, 32 years total in Chicago now.
32 years, and does it seem like yesterday you took that trip from San Francisco to Minneapolis?
It does. It kind of does. It really does. That was my first time off the West Coast, and I haven't made it back. I've been a Midwesterner ever since.
Well, you know, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I think some people might confuse you and Paul because they say, Ron Majors, he was here until a few years ago. That was Paul Majors, but you might remember Ron Majors was here at Channel 5, and then, again, Paul at Channel 11. When you're here and you're part of our homes every night, you are family. And so on Facebook and Twitter, when I said who our guests would be today, we had a lot of likes, so, and a lot of people wanted to comment and wish you well. Those that don't see you on TV every night anymore, but it's great to have you on the airwaves here in Minneapolis, St. Paul again. Hopefully we'll be able to do it again sometime.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And keep watching tcmedianow.com if you want to see yourself, Ron, from 35 years ago.
I get a kick out of it. Yeah. Thank you for posting it.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for being here. Ron Majors, live from Chicago of WLS-TV and formerly of KSTP-TV. Next week, join us for some artists from the song Clouds. That is the Zach Zobiak song. And this was the number one song on iTunes. They'll be performing live in studio and talking about how that track was recorded. Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1212.